Hello, and welcome to Roll for Topic, a roundtable discussion about topics related to running role-playing games. I'm Chris Salzman.
And I'm Andy Rao.
Andy, happy Player's Handbook 1 D&D release month.
Yes.
to all who celebrate. Yeah, so you had posted a picture of you getting the special variant cover edition that you can only get at your friendly local gaming store of the Player's Handbook, and I got so jealous that I went out, like, I think within an hour or two of seeing your photo and getting it. Yeah.
I have really nothing to say for myself. I spent the last 2 years just, like, simmering in a grudge against Wizards of the Coast for their corporate decisions. Nothing against, like, the individuals that, you know, write the content or, you know, do the art and stuff, but... And yet here we are. And I was in the gaming store. I didn't even realize the Player's Handbook was out yet.
Yeah.
And I was just looking at other stuff and I was like, whoa, what, that's new. Oh my goodness. Like, is it this time already? Like,
yeah.
Well, what am I going to do?
Yeah. Yeah, pretty much the same here. I mean, like, I have not actively played D&D in a few years either, but I just saw it. I was like, well, I'm going to get it anyway at some point. Yeah. I might as well grab it as long as the special one is there. Yeah, it is. So I flipped through it. I've read a little bit of it, and I will say it is in a bunch of little subtle ways, it's just an improvement over the 10-year-old Player's Handbook.
Yeah.
Right. So I think if you have any love for D&D left in your heart, I would say it's probably worth at least picking up to flip through. Just to see what's in there.
I was gonna say, if you're like me, I mean, you own every edition, you know. I've purged my collection at times, and I've gotten new stuff for it and stuff, but the thing I've never really gotten rid of are the core books for each edition of D&D. And each of them, I've played every single one of them, and they each are a piece of my life. They're attached to, like, real life memories.
We were like, I think the thing for me, like, we're just flipping through, like, the art's really good. And it just,
yes, it is.
I don't know. Like, I feel like this is a good marker of a book for me, is like, when I'm reading it, I sort of want to stop reading it and just make a character, right? Like, it's, yeah. Like, I think that's sort of what it is. And, like, we were discussing, friendly or not, on Discord about this. It's like, you know, it's like such a long wait between these books for, like, D&D. And, like, in between, the past 10 years of gaming has been, like, phenomenal, right? There's, like, all sorts of interesting new games coming out all the time, like, that are just very much like the antithesis to D&D, or, like, trying to do it in a different way and stuff like that. And, like, but still, like, this comes out, I'm like, oh well, I mean, this is, you know, a lot of people play this game. I like this game, so
yeah.
So I grabbed it. We'll see. You know, like, I have been I've been maybe jokingly saying that I'm going to get a campaign started, but I think I might actually have to just, you know, at least get a one shot.
Yeah.
One shot going, where we can all sort of try out some of the new character creation stuff.
I think what most people are finding is, like they said, the changes seem to be streamlining and quality of life improvements. It's not, it's more than, like, errata, but it's definitely not a new addition. Would you, Chris, personally like it better if, like, every 3 years when they had to order a new print run for the Player Handbook, they did a slightly more than errata pass at it? Or is it fine for you to, you know, let it go a decade and then accumulate all the updates into one new book?
Yeah, I think if I played more frequently, I'd probably want that. But I mean, for me, this cadence is totally fine, right? Like, it's like, I will, I'm not going to say this is the last Player's Handbook I'll ever buy, but, like, I'm perfectly happy with what I'm seeing with this. Yeah. And I think, like, just the nature of D&D being, like, slightly more complicated is, like, you're always going to have errata, right? Like, so it's sort of just, like, part of it for me. I'm also not, like, an online player, so I have to imagine that, like, all the tools online, they update subtly over time. Maybe not. I don't know. Maybe that's a poor assumption. But yeah, it seems like, yeah, like, for the style of play that I'm often going to be doing, like, this is totally fine, right? Like, you know, the reality is, if I got people together to play a campaign, we would probably just all use this book. Like, I don't think everybody's going to show up with their own with their own copy. Yeah.
Here's the biggest question I have about the new Player's Handbook. Are we in a new era in which D&D is always gonna look like this? Is D&D pretty much gonna be fifth edition from now on, with, like, every 5 to 10 years we get a new handbook that updates some things and stuff? Because the rhythm of this kind of hobby industry is that, I mean, all the previous editions of D&D have been maybe with the exception of like the jump from first to second edition, have been overhauls of how you do these like D&D concepts, how you articulate them as game rules. We got at least another 5 to 10 years of 5e, which mm-hmm. is what I sense from this. Maybe the way D&D is now is going to just kind of settle to be, this is the mechanical way that you do D&D.
Yeah, it's sort of like it's a solved game design problem, right, at this point, right? Like, you don't go back to chess and you're like, oh, I really can't wait for chess to, you know, chess two. It's like,
yeah,
like this is what it's going to be with like slight tweaks. I think that's probably okay, and it also makes me very glad that there's other game systems out there. I mean, it's like, you know, like I would love to open up a big, gorgeous, like epically produced player's handbook like this and find that they had cribbed like a ton of stuff from Powered by the Apocalypse, right? Like, and that's just not going to happen, right? There might be like some token nods towards it, maybe in, you know, some of the narrative sections or things like that, but it's not going to be like, you're not going to have like, oh, and like also you have these list of moves you can use in your roll 2d6 and there's, you know, you know, there's consequences, and like, it's just not going to happen. Yeah. And I think that's probably okay. I mean, like, for me, it's like, it's a flavor. For better or for worse, Wizards of the Coast does this really well. Like, you know, so if you want to play this flavor of game, yeah. I mean, I think the curiosity for me will be if in 10 years it is still the juggernaut and pop culture that it is right now.
Hmm.
Yeah, I mean, and you've been in this hobby longer than I. Like, my sense is that it sort of ebbs and flows throughout the years. And probably right now, or I guess maybe as like 3 years ago or so, right? It was probably at its peak. Yeah, so I'm wondering if things drop off more, and then it's not the juggernaut, and who knows, Call of Cthulhu becomes the big thing in the United States or something like that. It's like, well, I mean, then would they try to make a big drastic change? I don't know. It's sort of fun to speculate about, but it's also like there's such a big tent of other stuff happening in the game space that I'm not very concerned about it.
Any kind of online discussion about the industry and about Wizards of the Coast and D&D, and I definitely participate in this. It is, you know, it tends to have this doomy feel.
Mm-hmm.
But the reality is there are so many games out there I want to buy that like I don't even have the budget for, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, I have too many games, and there's even more I want to get. Even if we enter into something of like a downward, if the hobby starts to slump a little bit, we still are in this ludicrous golden age of like of games. And I mean, if you like D&D, but you have this like extremely minor nitpick with it, there's like a whole game whose organizing principle is D&D, but with this nitpick addressed, right? Like,
yes. So. Yeah. Yeah. It's like in some ways it'd be nice if we went into a slump because I had to finally like, you know, catch up.
Right. Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Like Splatbook had on the most recent episode had +1 Tony on. He was talking about some of the zines and games and stuff that he puts out, and just like all this stuff sounds like it's so fascinating, right? It's like, it's sort of like indie press stuff, but it's like, I mean, I will be as excited to pick up something from his company that I am picking up the player's handbook. It's like, sort of like, one drop in a big ocean. Maybe like a bucket full in a big ocean.
So, okay. Before I throw a topic at you, just, I want to do a real quick check. And you and I are both running games at our upcoming convention.
Yes.
Mini convention, whatever you want to call it. And I'm just curious, do you want to give us a little peek at what, I guess we're less than a week out, what does Chris's game prep look like right now? Is it like still on the shelf, haven't touched it? Or have you been pouring it over? Have you been lying in bed, like running through ideas?
Yeah. Doing a lot of running through ideas in my head. You know, I took some time last week to just sort of write out my rough structure and what I want to happen. So like this happens every time I run a convention game, especially at Archon. I get this idea in my head and I can't sort of let it go and do the easier version of it. So this year I'm running a heist set in the Robin Hood universe. And I think we've talked a little bit about this on the podcast, so we'll get too far into it, but there's going to be various like dexterity mechanics and stuff. So I'm both writing the adventure and writing a handful of new mechanics and like trying to get everything together. So it's going to be tight. I think I'll make it, right? We've got 4 or 5 days until I like kind of the drop dead. I can't put anything else into it, into it sort of thing. But yeah, I think it'll be good. There's going to be a couple things that will be like, well, I sure hope this works works at the table. But right, I think it's going to be super fun.
Yeah
and I don't want to get into any kind of spoilers there. But I did workshop a mechanic that I'm playing with my daughter for sort of like the final part of the adventure that they're going to be doing. And it worked out really well. Like she was immediately asking, hey, can we play that more? So I think that's good, but she's
I have
nine,
no idea so. What your game's going to look like. But when you talk about this stuff, I have this mental picture, like, am I going to look up from the con and on the, are you going to be like outside on the front lawn with your group? You'll all be like passing a hula hoop over your shoulders or something like that. Like, I can't wait to see.
Yeah. Unfortunately, it is going to be even sillier than that. So okay. I will save it. I'm sure we'll do a recap episode where we talk about, you know, what went well and what didn't. My suspicion is that all the other tables at the con are going to kind of look over at us and be like, can they just shut up?
Yes.
So, yeah. Anyway, so since we're the con organizers, I will put our table like off in a corner somewhere.
Okay, yeah. Good. Yeah.
Yeah. What about you? What are you? Yeah. How's your prep going?
Yeah. I'm running Twilight 2000. Mm-hmm. I ran it 2 years ago and I haven't run it since. So This will basically be the second time I'm running the game. And the fun part of Twilight 2000 for me the last time I ran it was that there wasn't a plot. I had no scenes planned out. Like we drew cards, which is like rolling on random tables. So you just, in that game, you draw cards and like, oh, this is what you encounter. And you combine where the PCs felt like going on the map. I didn't give them any direction with random, you know, card draws of what they bump into while they're doing it.
Nice.
It was pretty remarkable how even in just 2 or 3 hours, it did create something you would call like a story or kind of a coherent experience. So
that's amazing.
So prep wise, that means I don't have a plot like really, you know, I don't have to give them a story. I don't have to plan an encounter with like a boss or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
But I do have to master these Twilight 2000 mechanics, which are closer to squad leader than to whatever's on the other side from squad leader.
Yes,
so
yeah.
I mean like hexes and suppression fire and stuff. So like the total amount of work is kind of coming out to be about the same because I have to do more. I'm going to have a better handle on you can't hand wave combat in a system where like the whole point of it is like combat's like realistic and gritty and So that's where I'm at.
Yeah, there's a photo of you running that game 2 years ago where I think it's like sort of towards the end of the session that you're running, and everybody is standing up at the table,
I know,
looking at it with like they're trying to solve some sort of like war room style thing. Yeah, like and just like super tense, super dialed in. It's very cool. Yeah. I mean, I love that photo, kind of like, just to me that sort of typifies the con
yeah,
in general.
Agreed.
But like, yeah, I'm hoping you get that reaction again.
I haven't heard that before, but like, I do think that like the stand up phase of your game is like a neat thing to celebrate when it happens, when people are so intent on what's going on that they like get up and start worrying, visibly worrying over the table map and stuff. So anyway, okay. Well, I don't want to spend too much more time on that, but I think both of us will need to do a little recap after the con.
Mm-hmm.
I will be running D&D or a D&D alike starting after the con for my family. And I want to talk about that, but not in this episode.
Oh, so. Yeah. Okay. Well, there's a teaser for like the next month or two of podcast episodes.
Indeed. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I have a topic I can throw out there if you're willing to, you know, deal with yet another no advance warning topic from Andy.
This is my favorite way to do this. So yeah, go for
it. All right. This is a little bit different one. We've talked about a couple of like kind of mechanical D&D elements in the recently, alignment and language and stuff. So here's a little bit more of a setting thing. Chris, how do you handle criminals in your game world, and specifically how do you handle like the presence of like a criminal underworld or people that live outside the law in your settings? Does that happen in your games? So I have some thoughts, but let me just throw it out to you. In the last like D&D game that you ran, was there an outside the law organization, and what was the role that it played?
Well, I think every table I've played with seems to just be full of criminals. So
yeah.
I think there's something that is, I think, like, for players, creating a character that is sort of like has some, a bit of that like edge to them, I don't know, at least in the circles I run in, is pretty pretty alluring, right, to say the least. Yeah, so I'm trying to think, like, the last like D&D game that I ran, I don't really know if there was like an explicit criminal element other than like the bad guys they were trying to, you know, capture, right? Something I've used in a handful of times for a setup of like the hey, so you meet in a tavern, like that sort of setup is like, hey, you meet in prison, why are you there?
Oh, right? Interesting.
Yeah, I find like that's a really good way to kind of like get people thinking about like, oh, like, did I actually do something wrong? And do I feel bad about it? Do I not care? Or did I not do something wrong? You know, like, what? How did I find myself in this circumstance?
What are the odds? All four of us are in here and we didn't do anything wrong.
I know, we didn't do anything wrong. It's just, it's all that Duke who, probably that Duke has something bad going on. But yeah, but I mean, I think that's a good way. But yeah, so like D&D aside, right? Like, I mean, I played a lot of Blades in the Dark, right? And that's like a very explicit, like you are considered criminals, right? Like that's the whole setup for it. So in Blades in the Dark, right, you have all these like sort of factions and stuff working within the city. And it's like there is like a, you know, police faction, right? You know, like you have sort of like those things. So, I mean, part of the game is figuring out like how does your gang like interface with all these different factions, right? Like, and with the understanding that you are doing like illegal stuff. That's kind of an interesting, I think, counterpoint to like the, oh, you're this law abiding set of heroes, right? Like you have this other game where it's like, oh, you are explicitly criminals. Like, how does that work?
Have you ever played in or run like a fantasy game where the role of traditional hero was understood by the setting to be a criminal role? So Blades in the Dark, you're like, you know, you're smugglers and extortionists, and you're capital C criminals, right? Have you played in a setting where stealing stuff out of the tomb is illegal, or causing trouble with like the goblin tribe over the hill is illegal?
Yeah.
Have you played in a game like that where like the default thing the game really wants you to do that we so often cast as heroic is not seen as heroic in the setting?
Yeah, no, I have not. But that is a fascinating question. I guess, have you ever done?
Not exactly. Back in the day, I ran a couple of games that really amounted to like one shots where the PCs were kind of employed by like a thieves guild. You know, there's like, there's always a thieves guild in all these settings. And
and
I always think like, man, I really, it would be fun to dig into like, how does the thieves guild really work in this setting? Like, what do they do? Like, what's their relationship to the law? What's their relationship to like the average person? But so I've run a few things where like the PCs were doing jobs for like the thieves guild. That's about as far as it's gone. And I think those were more like Blades of the Dark type runs where, go steal some jewels from this person. I mean, it's like clearly against the law, nothing really quote heroic about it. So I guess the answer is no, I've not really run a game where kind of adventuring was illegal, or even where adventuring was like looked down at. Like there's some settings like Warhammer and stuff lend themselves to the PCs being like viewed at the low end of the social ladder, not near the top. Like you don't want them in your town. They cause trouble for you. Your tavern's always in a shambles when they leave, you know, that sort of thing. When I run my next game of D&D, I will be running it with like an established campaign, but well, I mean, I'm not going to like dance around this for no reason. I'm going to run Curse of Strahd.
Yes.
And that's in a somewhat coherent setting. And it's like run by an evil monster. And everything about it is bad. And I was just wondering, like, what would the criminal outlaws, who are the people that like live outside the moral bounds of this like horrible society? What do they do? Like, what's their deal? How do they relate to like the other people that they live with every day who they're on opposite ends of like the social spectrum?
For characters, right, like you sort of want them to feel like they're doing the right thing, right? So like even if it's the right thing for the wrong reasons, right, like it's like that's the inciting reason why they want to go on these adventures. So it sounds like what you're talking about is more like a, like, hey, I've sort of chosen this career path, but it's being considered illegal by the powers that be. So it's not even really like a morality question necessarily, yeah. More of like, right. This is just like, this is what we do. And like, okay, so this government doesn't really think that it's right, but I don't really care because I need to go do this thing. And I sort of need to figure out how to navigate that. Yeah. Is that where you're getting at? Or is it more just like people that are like, well, I don't care, I'm going to do this for my own.
No. That's exactly what I was getting at.
Okay.
The other time this had come up, so in the course of running Masks of Nyarlathotep, the criminal underworld, it was always in the background. And so the PCs are trying to solve these crimes and do these investigations, and they have kind of corrupt law enforcement people that they need to kind of dance around. Mm-hmm. And some of the bad guys basically use the criminal underworld as a way to like exert pressure on the PCs. Mm-hmm. But it just got me thinking, like, if you look at the way that like organized crime, like the mafia in the US and like the Yakuza in Japan, mm-hmm. they operate, they don't operate by just like by only preying and causing trouble.
Yeah, yeah.
They do that. They're horrible, but they offer like services that people either can't or have difficulty doing through legal channels, right?
Yeah.
Same thing. If you look at like drug cartels in some countries, like, I mean, there no one on paper would ever say this is good that this organization is here and what they're doing mm-hmm. is good, but they do offer services. And so I was thinking in the terms of Cthulhu, like, what if like the criminal underworld was like an alternate way to get answers? Like, how could I entice the PCs to like get involved with it, I guess? And mm-hmm. the point would be to have them get in over their heads or yes. to tangle with like bad people that. Mm-hmm. I mean, the purpose would be to ultimately to create drama. But like, what would it take to create some incentives to be like, you know, there's an easier way to get a passport really quickly.
Yeah.
Right. Like, yeah. If you talk to this, go to this bar at this time, and this guy can kind of can tell you about another guy. And mm-hmm. like, then two adventures later, you're in debt to some like, you know, really unpleasant people. And hopefully yeah. that's brought a lot of fun. Right.
Yeah. There's I'm thinking about a couple things right now. So I recently read the book Artemis, which is, we're not gonna get into it. There's other podcasts yeah. that do, but it's not a very good book. But like the one sort of interesting thing from that was this like notion of the criminal element being sort of like a system of power within a society. So if you remove the criminal, like if you have someone that is in charge, like sort of running the smuggling ring in your city or whatever, or, you know, like the drug ring or whatever, and it's like it can help you sort of maintain like a stability almost. It's like if that person has some rules and some honor and stuff, like they're, you know, they're not going to bring in certain drugs or whatever into the city. If you remove them, it creates a power vacuum. Like, so like you're always going to have smuggling, like you're always going to have these things in your city. Yeah. It's just sort of like pick who you want to be in charge of that necessarily, right? Like, cause you're not gonna be able to root it out completely. And I thought that was like a somewhat interesting concept of like,
yeah,
you know, like you're going to have this, like you're going to have the black market for passports or something like that. So do you want it to be the guy that like just needs some money, or do you want it to be the guy that like wants to give out passports because he wants to blow up like your whatever, right? Like, yeah. Like, so, I mean, there's something I think really interesting you could play with that. It's like, yeah, okay, good job, heroes. Like you got rid of the criminal underground here. Like you got rid of, I don't know, like thinking about Curse of Strahd, for example, is right. Like, you know, like, okay, so you got rid of like whatever was keeping Strahd from getting power, and now all of a sudden Strahd's in power, right? Like whatever that is, like, I don't know, like maybe that's some sort of like religious function, or there's a bunch of werewolves that are, you know, like running around or something like that, that you take out, and then suddenly Strahd has an opening and it becomes much, much worse. So I think there's a lot that you could play with there. I mean, I think especially in Strahd, because like you have this like, you know, clearly very evil person, but also is sort of controlling the whole area, presumably doing some good things, but also kind of keeping everybody down. The threats to that are going to be like, yeah, some sort of trade route. Like it's going to be some sort of other religion. It's going to be maybe a rival cult. Like you have like all these options, I think, for your players to choose from for stuff that Strahd's going to consider criminal, but are also like sort of good, you know, good, but might lead to like some situations where you're indebted to people that you don't want to be indebted to.
Yeah, absolutely. When I've created cities or settings in the past, I mean, I've always taken this sort of very organized top down, you know, what's the system of government? Like who's the mayor here? Who's, who's the ruling council, that sort of thing. When I wonder if maybe a more interesting question is like, who are the power factions? Like, so you created this city and it's this one democracy run by a ruling council of wise elders. Who has that shut out? Like, yes. Right. Like, so who lost power because that is the system, and how will the PCs engage with them? Like in the course of the adventuring work they do. Right.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. Yeah. I just keep on thinking about like, if we could get Robert Caro to run a game, a tabletop game, like how fascinating his version of whatever, you know, like of Neverwinter would be.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Just realizing what I said was very Caro-esque.
I know.
His thing is all about power. So,
I mean, it is one lens, I think, to look at any system, though. And I think it's a very important lens to look at stuff, because like almost every law gets passed is sort of like a power dynamic in some way. Right.
Yeah.
Like, I think there's
someone exerted power over a process or an opposition to make it happen. Right.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. And it's like, if I mean, I think a lot of those things can be kind of a net positive for humanity. But like, if you pass a law that says, like, you can't dump toxic waste into our drinking water, it's like, well, like, I mean, yeah, definitely don't do that. But then also the place that needs to find a spot for the toxic waste, it's like, well, now they feel powerless, right? Like, whether or not that's a good or bad thing, I think it's a very clear answer. But I mean, you can think about things in those terms a lot too, right? Like, so if you started with a city and started with sort of its natural resources and stuff available to it, like, and it's like, okay, so first maybe the people that have the power are the people that have the land near the river, right? So they can, they can generate power from like the water, or plant their plants and stuff like that. Like, you start there and you can start extrapolating out of like, okay, then the guy that builds the bridge has more power. Like, and you take that a couple generations, and then all of a sudden you have like a city council that's entirely based on, I don't know, a boat in that river or whatever. Yeah. So I don't know. I mean, I think it's a really interesting to play with, like thinking about it. So for this Curse of Strahd campaign, I guess, have you identified like, oh, this could be the interesting in for them that isn't just like, oh, you're from a family of vampire slayers and you got to go kill Strahd.
The easy thing to do would be like, oh, well, the criminals in this world are like the good guys, right? The resistance, like, and there's people in the setting that are fighting against Strahd, and you would call them resistance. That's interesting. Like, that's one of the power factions at work in the setting, and that's great. What I'm interested in doing is, because the PCs, by the nature of what they're doing, are like right close to the line of criminal behavior at all times, right? Because they're carrying weapons around, they're killing stuff.
Yep.
They're taking loot, whatever. So even if they're doing that, even if they're on the side of the angels, they're always just like 1 foot away from like being wanted criminals, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And the people that would serve the PCs would be people that provide services to the criminals of the setting, right?
Yeah.
How can, like, in the course of visiting the blacksmith and buying weapons or doing little errands for people, how can some of that bring them into contact with, I guess, the quote underworld? How can that bring them into contact with a different power faction, maybe one on the outs? So I don't know. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, that makes a ton of sense. I mean, just your comment about the blacksmith is really good, because it's like, if you are right, I'm thinking a lot about John Wick right now too, right? Like, John Wick's whole like shadow, like, network that he has underground. It's like John Wick can't go to the normal hospital. They would just be like, what happened? We're calling the police, right? Like, he needs to go to like a guy that's not gonna ask any questions.
You've been shot 302 times.
Yes. Yeah. How are you still walking? Yeah, like 300 of these bullets are from different guns, right? It's like, yeah. So so you have like that. I mean, I think like within the fiction that you're talking about, like, they could try to go to a blacksmith, but that blacksmith is gonna be like, I can't work on this weapon. Like, you could use that to kill Strahd. Like, get out of here.
Oh,
right. So it's
yes.
like you almost just have like this, like, refusing services, right? Like, of no, like, this is not the place for you. Yeah. I mean, and then you could also play with like kind of resources too, of like, I don't know, you really need like silver bullets for some reason, right? And it's like, well, you can't get those. Like, the only guy that has those, is using all the silver for whatever, like Strahd's fancy amulets and stuff like that. I mean, there's a ton you could do with that.
I hadn't really thought about like what are the nitty gritty ways that Strahd would make sure nobody gets any ideas. And like, you're right, no silver, right? Mm-hmm. Silver is not readily available. No, whatever, no weapons of this type and that type, and no armor of you know, that's fancier than this.
Yeah, you can't stay at that inn. Like, why do you think you can stay at that inn? Yeah, it's right. Like a, but also, yeah. Then there's no place to sleep outside because there's patrols all the time. It's right. So like, you're on day three of not having a long rest. Like,
what's no loitering, and your party of five like violates the like gathering in public rule.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And you could happily get an inn. I just need you to hand over all of your crosses, like, you know, like, yeah, whatever.
Yes.
Yeah, all of your crosses and wooden sticks need to go in box. I don't know why you have so many wooden sticks.
Pat you down for garlic and
yes. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Well, Chris, we've been talking for a while, and so it's time for us to wrap up because we both got stuff to get back to. But do you have any final closing thoughts on like facing the PCs with like the criminal element of a setting?
I really like your thought of like they're doing something that is illegal, although it's sort of feels right. I think there's a lot you can do with that. I mean, even if that's just, thinking about like the British Museum and how many, you know, artifacts they have liberated from various places and stuff. It's like, yeah, like England might think that's okay, but you know, I don't know if India does, right? So it's like, I think there's a lot you could do there with just sort of like, hey, we're on this mission, you know, and your local government doesn't agree with me, but like my local government says this is okay. Yeah, so I think there's a lot you could do with that, and even just like not understanding the rules of maybe the society that you start to interact with.
Okay, do you want to wrap us up? Do you have any closing thoughts here?
Yeah, so we have been Roll for Topic. We are part of the Roll for It Media podcasting network. Our sister show, The Splat Book with John Corey, is wonderful. I think I mentioned he had +1 Tony on, I think, of +1 Experience, who they make a bunch of games and kind of help out, produce some games, and also sell like beard care products as well. So yeah, go check them out. It was a really good episode. I loved what they had just to say and like talk about, just about games and running games and sort of like designing stuff too. Yeah, so it's a really good one. You can go find it at thesplatbook.com. Otherwise, for us, we have Roll for Topic Con coming up this week. So by the time y'all are listening to this, if you listen to it on the day we release it, in a few days, we will be at a day-long convention in Ann Arbor. We're super excited. We've got more attendees than last year. It's a little bit nerve-wracking.
Yes.
But yeah, it should be really good. And then our hope is that, well, I guess I haven't really talked with you, Andy, about this, so I'll put you on the spot. Are you're still planning on doing the trivia contest?
Yes.
Okay,
yes.
Great.
Yep.
Yeah, so we recorded that last year, so you can go and listen to that if you want to, just to see what sort of devious trivia Andy gets himself up to when given the possibility. So yeah, we're going to be doing that again, and so that should probably be our next episode. That will go live, maybe with a few con thoughts as well. But yeah, that will do it for us. So okay. I've been Chris Salzman.
I've been Andy Rao.
And remember, if your player's having fun, you're a great GM.